Well, I'm excited for today. My name is Austin Vondracek, and I'm the pastor here at Rosewood Church. And if I've not had a chance to meet you yet, I hope to soon. And it is good to have y'all here today. And let me tell you a little bit about where we've been, and we'll talk about where we're going. If you've been around, you know all this already. If you're just coming back from like living at your campsite for the last 12 weeks, and now Labor Day's over and you're back again, let me tell you where we've been. 2 weeks ago, we started this series, Love Relationships in the Church, and we talked about dating. Last week, we talked about marriage and keeping up the pursuit of your partner. And this morning, we're talking sex. And for some of you, you're here for the first time, and you're thinking, there are 20 churches within walking distance. And I chose the one that's talking about sex this morning. So, hey, if you're new, welcome to Rosewood. It is good. to have you. It is good to have you. So really today is kind of the talk, right? Like, you know what the talk is. Everyone knows what the talk is. You say the talk and people know what it is. The talk is the talk that you have with your parents when your parents give you the birds and the bees and all of that. And in some ways that's what this is, but in some ways it's not. I remember my talk. I don't know if you do. I remember my talk because, I remember where I was. And I found that a lot of people remember that because it was so uncomfortable that it became a memory seared into your brain as far as where you were and how old you were. And so for me, I was in the car with my mom, and we were at the stop sign on Greencastle Road waiting to turn east onto 120th Street, which turns into Division in Swisher, Iowa. That's where I was. You can find it on a map right where I got the talk. But I'll tell you what, I am grateful. I don't know what my mom said. I'm grateful she had it with me. Because for a lot of people, they don't get the talk. Parents don't talk to their kids about sex. And the second question I have for you today is, if you had that talk, how old were you? I don't know how old I was. I know I was in the front seat, but that's the only real frame of reference I have about how old I was. Chances are that according to most people who talk about the talk that they had with their parents, you probably got the talk after you had already figured out everything, so you thought, right? Or you got busted, and this was a way for your parents or your parent to kind of get you back on track after something happened. The talk tends to be a reactive conversation. It's also something that feels like it should be avoided until the very last minute, like learning to change a tire. You want to know it if you need to know it, but if you don't need to know it, you don't really want to know it. You don't really care. So whether your talk was good or bad, whether the talk even happened for you or not, and whether you want to have this conversation now with your kids or not, or later in the future, talking about sex seems to revolve around an idea that is sometimes difficult to communicate, and it's that sex isn't just physical. That seems to be the sticking point, the difficulty of how do we express this? Sex is more than just a physical action. And that also seems to be the point where disagreements over sex converge, with one side claiming that it can be a casual physical encounter that doesn't need to be anymore unless you decide that it means more. And the other side saying, no, it is more. It can't be less. It is not just a physical act. And it is, sex is, biologically, spiritually, and psychologically difficult to pin down. And it's still somewhat shrouded in mystery. And I think that only proves that it is a complex topic and something worth spending some time on. So here's where I want to go this morning, because there are many paths that we could take on this subject. Now, like I said, I do not believe that sex, you see where I'm going, right? You just, oh, then he took it off, right. You're getting ahead of me. But I really believe, as I said, sex is not isn't just physical, because the God that created us made it so. God designed men and women to be people who had sex to fulfill his plans and be united in a beautiful, exclusive relationship that intertwines a married couple's physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual selves into one. In fact, when we understand God's plan for sex, we understand that sex is good. Sex is a good thing. And sex is not, excuse me, I'm getting over some stuff. Sex is not a dirty topic for us, okay? Sex is not, it should not be taboo to talk about. If Christians remain silent on sex because they find it uncomfortable, then young people especially, they are still going to learn about it. The question is, how much control do you want to have in that conversation? So let's start from the beginning, the very beginning, like way at the beginning, Genesis 1 beginnings, all right? Starting in Genesis 1, this gives us a picture of God's creative potential as he pieces together the universe from scratch. And at a point in the story, God looks at Adam, all on his lonesome, and sees that it is not good. In fact, this is a surprising twist to the story, because up to this point, everything's been good. The moon and the stars and the sun, all good. The land, the water, the animals, the marine life, the birds and the air, all good. But then he looks at Adam, who's all on his own, and says, no, not good. We're not done here yet. And so God creates Eve and uses a bit of Adam to create her, which is really also a diversion from a pretty predictable creation plan or pattern of creation. And God uses his creation. This is the first time where he uses a creation as a starting point to create another living thing, another person. And the two are physically intertwined immediately. So God creates man and woman, and he gives them their first instruction. Genesis 1:28 said, God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Be fruitful and increase in number. So God's done creating. And then he creates, and the last part, he just makes sure that humans are just like he wants. And he says, okay, now you. I've been creating. In fact, I've been working hard. I'm going to take a day off. You, I give this creative ability, this ability to create, I now give to you. I mean, you think about that. The first command by God to humanity was an invitation to create life. And we know how life is created. I mean, you think about how human beings are the pinnacle of God's creation, and he gives us the power to create. Sex is the means by which God creates his most prized possession. Sex is out of this world, important to God, and he gives it to humanity, to you, as a gift. But like virtually everything that is important and meaningful in life, there are parameters that are set up in order to maintain its special nature or its meaning. And the parameters for sex that God puts in place are marriage. And Jesus speaks of it firsthand in Matthew 19:5-6. He says, for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. So Jesus associates from the get-go, he associates sex with this new and permanent family unit. And think about the phrase that he uses, two becomes one. Two becomes one. Sex unites two people like no other act can. And he leaves us with this mysterious and ambiguous description of the sexual experience. And here's how I understand that phrase, that two become one, which is such an odd, two become one. What else goes from two and becomes one? Well, here's how I kind of understand it. I think the experience that Jesus is describing is what we might today call intimacy. And I really believe that while not everyone is looking for intimacy necessarily in their life, everyone is longing for intimacy. And intimacy is strongest through exclusivity. the more inclusive you become in your sexual life through multiple partners and pornography, both before marriage and after marriage, the weaker your intimacy becomes for the person you hope to share it with forever. Paul's letter to the Christians in Corinth, the first letter to the Christians in Corinth contains, I think, the most straightforward teaching on the topic. He provides good reason to support his instruction to abstain from any act of sexual immorality and that might diminish intimacy between two people. But before I read it, I want to tell you what Paul does not say, okay? Before we read it, I want to read what Paul does not say. Before we see what he says as the reason for this, I want to look at the reasons he does not give. Paul does not say you shouldn't have sex before marriage because I said so, because you'll get an STD, because it's only for married people, because you'll get pregnant and you won't be able to care for the baby, because it's bad. These are all, this is five, we could go on, of all the reasons that Paul does not include as to why you should not have sex before you're married or engage in any sort of sexual immorality. Yet these are the reasons that we tend to give. These are the reasons we tend to give as to why you shouldn't do it. So what does Paul say instead? Now here's the answer or the reason that Paul gives. He says, flee from sexual immorality. All other sins a person commits are outside the body. But whoever sins sexually sins against their own body, from 1 Corinthians 6:18. So here's what we say. He's saying, I'm going to phrase it in a different way. Sexual sin is not less sinful or more sinful, but it does affect you differently. It's not less sinful or more sinful, but it does affect you differently. Let me tell you what I mean by that and what I think that Paul is really getting at with that. For one, it is not less sinful. This is what popular culture and marketing inundates every person with, that sex is less sinful, if not just not sinful at all. That there's nothing wrong with any sort of sexual expression. Any sexual expression is love. And so that doesn't really matter whether it's however it is, as long as it's safe and as long as it's okay and with both people. And here are the three things that I think that really are being communicated to us through this less sinful kind of approach to sexual immorality. For one, it's a message that sex is casual, right? It's no big deal. Sex is casual. Everybody's doing it, and it's just for fun. It's something you do to feel good, right? Like a good meal. You eat a good meal, and you just feel good. Well, you know, you just have good sex and you feel good. You're satisfied. There's a second thing that will be told to you that inundates every one of us, that sex is essential, that you need to have sex. Now, here's a problem, though, that I see with some of this communication here, that on the one hand, it says that you're told that you should believe that sex is casual. It's no big deal. But on the other hand, you're told it's essential, right? And if you're not having it, is there something wrong with you? Are you odd? Are you broken? So on the one hand, no big deal. But on the other hand, big deal. Big deal, especially if you're not having it. What's wrong with you? Well, wait, I thought it was no big deal. So shouldn't it be no big deal if I'm not having sex or not engaging in something that God would call sexually immoral? And here's the third thing. Sex is primarily physical. That safe, consensual sex that is guarded against pregnancy is nothing but fun and a physical act. It doesn't have to be anything more unless you decide that it's going to be more. But at the same time, no one really believes that we're just bodies, right? That you're just a body with nothing more to you. That only what you can touch, it really encapsulates everything that you are. We also have a metaphysical mind and heart. And if you're a religious person, you might say that you have a soul. All of these things that can't necessarily be touched. You are not just a body, and sex is not just a physical act. When sex is reduced solely to a physical act, that's when we run the risk of hurting ourselves or, perhaps worse, hurting other people. And like any other major decision, the results follow us around, good or bad. So on the one hand, sex or sexually immoral behavior or thoughts or motives are not less sinful, as popular culture, marketing, all of that wants you to believe, but it's also not more sinful. And this would be my critique of what a message I've often heard come out of the church and churches that I love, that for some reason sexual immorality is more sinful than everything else. Well, let me tell you this. We need to lay off people, especially young people, and stop making sexual purity the litmus test for obedience in faith. When our sexual ethic, our decisions and opinions and thoughts about what is right and what is wrong sexually become divorced from the gospel message, then we find ourselves in the territory of legalism, where we believe that somehow actions can save us. You think about the woman who's caught in adultery in John 8. The woman who is caught in adultery, and if you've never heard the story, you've heard at least a line that comes from it. A woman is thrown out in the street. She's been caught mid-act, engaged in something sexually immoral. Throw her out in the street, and they basically say, Jesus, what do you think? And everyone at that point, while they're thinking he's going to talk, they're gathering stones to kill her with, because at that time, that was an appropriate punishment for someone like her who was engaged in sexually immoral behavior. And so Jesus says, as many people know, even if you've never cracked a Bible open, you've probably heard that he says, he who is without sin, or the person who is out without sin, they should cast the first stone. And everyone puts their stones down. And then he has a conversation with this woman that he is not condemning her, and then has a conversation about what this new life could look like. Now, here's the thing about that. Her sexual impurity isn't her condemnation, but neither is her commitment to sexual purity her salvation. Salvation is found in God's grace through faith, not the adherence to God's plan for sexuality. So sexual sin is not less sinful. It's also not more sinful. But God says through Paul that it does affect you differently, right? In this 1 Corinthians passage, he says all other sins was how he started. He said all other sins. So he's grouping every action, thought, and motive into everything, every action, thought, or motive that separates us from God. He says, okay, those are in one category, okay? All those sins are in one category. Then whoever sins sexually sins against their own body. And he puts that in this other category. Sexual sin is categorized differently by God, and this is what Paul knew. I think this gets at something that Paul knew, and God has known since the beginning, that for many people, they only learn this lesson until it's too late. It's that when we sin sexually, we hurt ourselves. When we sin sexually, we hurt ourselves. If there's one person here who gets this, who understands it for the first time, all of this is going to be worth it. When we sin sexually, we hurt ourselves. When a person sins sexually, they literally sin against themselves. And sinning against yourself is like stealing from yourself. Sexual sin robs you of your own future and your future intimacy with your spouse. Sexual sin creates an obstacle to honesty, because sexual sin is the sin that we are most tempted to try to smuggle into a relationship unnoticed. At this point in the message, this was where I was just going to wrap it up, put a bow on it, pray, and be done, and be glad I didn't have to say sex much more in front of a church service, but I want to keep going a little bit. And the reason for that is that for many people, perhaps even many people in this room, you are going to push back against a lot of the things I'm saying and say that it's not true, that all this talk about uniting and becoming one flesh and unity are just words, they're just jargon used for the Christian version of a prudish and out-of-date religious expression. In fact, 70% of young adults and young Christians might even agree with that, might get on that, because that's how many statistically will put sex before marriage in terms of order of operations in a relationship. Now, I used to believe a lot of that too. In fact, God's design for sex was not something that I could really relate to until after I was married. But let me tell you a little bit about what I've observed as someone who provides premarital counseling for Christians and non-Christians, who sits down in a room and has these kind of conversations where I look you right in the eye. It's what every couple is like, oh, maybe he'll miss it. Maybe he'll skip that part. Nope. But these are conversations I have with Christians and non-Christians alike. From what I've seen, as far as how these conversations go, there's really no difference, okay? So here's what I've observed. If you think all this talk about oneness and purity and all of it is kind of bogus or out of date, here's what I've learned from people across the board. Okay, three things. Here's the first one. Couples often hide their history, their sexual history. And the more partners, the more they hide. The more partners, the more they hide. Some couples will blatantly lie, and lie about how many people they've been with. Other couples will lie by omission as far as how many people they've been with or who they've been with. Other couples say, I don't even want to know. I don't even want to know. That's the history, right? We don't even need to think about that. It's just us now, right? Now here's the thing, when this comes up and I talk with people through this, it tells me that there's a great deal of regret and shame because of some things that happened in the past. It tells me that what they were telling themselves about sex, that it was no big deal, has become a big deal now that they met someone who was the real deal. It used to be casual. But that doesn't hold up anymore as their relationship goes from the next level, from just dating and trying to understand one another, to committing for the rest of their lives. Now, here's the second thing I've picked up from premarital, is that couples where one or both of the individuals have had sex with another person or multiple partners, regardless, that the other person, or maybe both, struggle with jealousy and insecurity. They struggle with jealousy and insecurity because they know that the person that they're sleeping with or will sleep with has had sex with other people. So you can't help but get out of your mind, how do I stack up? Am I as good as the person or the people who came before? And what if I'm not? What if sexually I'm not as good as their ex-girlfriend or her ex-boyfriend? Are they gonna stay with me? What if I don't perform to their standards? What if I'm not performing to their standards? Jealousy robs sex of its intimacy. And here's the third thing. I found that many couples are concerned about sexual compatibility. Let me say it like this, okay? Every person is sexually compatible with way more people than they are relationally compatible with, okay? So in terms of judging a relationship first, let's look at this. First, judging a relationship based on your sexual compatibility has way too wide a margin for error, okay? Because you are sexually compatible, every one of us, with far more people than you are relationally compatible with. And you might think, and here's how it's so commonly thought among people. I mean, shouldn't you explore whether or not you are sexually compatible before you get married? Shouldn't you explore that? Here's how it was phrased when I was a kid. This is how I was always taught, not by my parents in the talk, other people. But here's how it was phrased to me in a somewhat logical sense. They said, well, you wouldn't buy a car without test driving it, would you? So why would you commit a lifetime to a person without a test drive as well, right? Well, here's what I have to say to that. Well, for one, that could be a whole nother sermon about the objectification of people, but that's obvious. Here, I want to look at it like this. First off, about sexual compatibility, okay? I'm not a biologist. I didn't take a lot of anatomy. But I know if one is a man and one is a woman, you're sexually compatible. Physically, it works, okay? So, you are sexually compatible. Let me tell you this as well. And I mean it. I truly mean this, that this is, because this is what so many people think. But let me tell you this. Worst case scenario, you are dating, you get engaged, you get married, you have sex for the first time on your marriage night, and the worst case scenario is it's terrible. It's like you're both dancing different dances, and you're just like bumping into each other. It's just not working. Okay? The first time is not the fairy tale that you had always dreamed of. Okay, let me tell you this, and I mean it here, okay? If that's you, or you know people who think that, if you are not sexually compatible at the very beginning, you get to spend the rest of your life becoming sexually compatible, and it's fun. It's really fun. Sexual compatibility, while important in a relationship, is far less important at the very beginning and in the dating phase. You'll make it work. I promise you. You'll like it too. So, like I said at the beginning, I just want to wrap this up here. Like I said at the beginning, sex is hard to talk about because it is such a complex act. But let me bring it kind of all back to this, okay? God is not against sex, but he is against its distortion because God is pro-people. And sex, outside of the boundaries that God has set, sets you up to hurt yourself and perhaps worse, you're going to hurt other people. And I pray that for every one of you, regardless of where you are in your life or in your life stage, I pray that the Lord blesses your sexuality immensely. I pray that you would enjoy it within the boundaries that will bring life to you and to the person who said, "I do," to you. Your mind, your body, your spirit, every bit of you for many, many years to come.